Welcome to Books, Beauty, and Business. Our goal is to motivate and inspire others to push limits, test boundaries, and climb personal ladders of success. I'm your host, Tawny Bro, and today we will be talking with Deepa Purushottaman. She is a former senior executive and corporate inclusion visionary. She was a senior partner at Deloitte and spent more than 20 years there helping her clients grow. She also helped the Deloitte's Women's Initiative, and she was the first Indian American woman and one of the youngest people to make partner in the firm's history. So needless to say, she has had an amazing career, an amazing success story in corporate America. The fact that she moved up so quickly and gained so much experience in that role led her over the last few years to step back from Deloitte, and she co-founded a membership-based community for professional women of color called Information. So she's really focused on women empowerment and helping women really own who they are and the value that they bring inside of a corporation. She wrote a book called The First, The Few, The Only, How Women of Color Can Redefine Power in Corporate America. So the fact that there are not enough women in management roles and senior leadership roles on boards is nothing new to us, right? We kind of have realized that is just where we're at this time. But I will tell you, it is definitely improving. The women on boards study says women now hold more than 29% of corporate boards, board seats. That is 2 points higher than just a couple years ago. And I also read that boards that have more diversity and women on the boards actually outperform boards that are not as diverse, which is awesome. So that is definitely an improvement. But I will tell you something else, and I heard this from an executive that a job opening was available, and as they were going through resumes, there were no female applicants. It was crazy. And they actually reached out to some of the female managers, like, why is no one applying to this executive leadership role? Like, I want to see everybody's resume, right? And who's interested? You guys, men apply for a job when they only meet 60% of the qualifications, but women apply if they only meet 100% of them. That means we're such rule followers that we're like, oh, if we don't, you know, check all the boxes and meet all the expectations, then let's not even try. Where men are like, heck, I'm going to give it a shot no matter what. And that doesn't surprise me then that we are not in positions that maybe we should be more prevalent in. I mean, obviously you want to be qualified, but if you are 60% of the way, ladies, like jump in. Just jump in and figure it out and see what it's about. See if it's something you enjoy. Because I guarantee we have all met people in positions in leadership, executive, C-suite roles, and we start talking to them about their qualifications or their improvement processes or whatever we talk about, and we're like, how did you ever get this job? You are not even qualified to have a conversation about this job, much less be in this role. So I really feel like there is something on our onus to just apply. If there is a job you're interested in, you got to apply. Even if you're at 60%, apply, ladies. Put yourself out there. Now, if you're overly qualified and you keep getting overlooked because you're working in the, you know, good old boys club, like that is where Deepa's research is really focused on, is changing the status quo of companies like that. But obviously, companies like her, where she has been moving up the ladder her whole career and was able to step away to help other women move up the ladder is quite impressive. I read another report that found that men are often hired or promoted based on their potential, women for their experience and track record. So like we are having to prove ourselves and get the experience to come to the table with the confidence and with the stats, right, to prove our worth and bring our value, where men can be hired just for their potential. So there is a huge gap there that definitely needs to be addressed in the culture that you're working in your own confidence, and then getting your butt out there and applying for some of this stuff that you know that you'd be really good at. So let's jump in and listen to what Deepa has to say about this.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and can you just share, like, tell us your journey. Like, how did you get here today?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a different journey in that I, out of grad school, recruited with Deloitte, which is a big, large professional services firm.
Oh, yeah.
I thought I would do a year or two of private sector experience because my background was actually policy and politics. That's what I went to grad school for.
Okay.
And I ended up at Deloitte for 21 years. And so just had a really, I call it magical, which is code for like lots of things, but just, you know, really grew a lot, had a lot of amazing experiences, a lot of different clients. And so just really loved it. And then all of a sudden I left 2 years ago. So it's at all, my new life is very recent.
Okay.
I left 2 years ago in the early stages of the pandemic before we called it the Great Resignation. And everyone told me I was, you know, losing my mind literally for leaving because I was leaving security and stability at a time when there was such uncertainty. But in some ways, I feel like everyone else caught up just a few months later where we had lots of people leaving. My leaving was a combination of, I think, growing questions around purpose because my background was politics. And I just started to see more and more what was happening in this country and just really questioning, like, am I doing my life's work? And then also getting sick, like just really big questions on health. And, you know, I had a very intense lifestyle. I traveled sometimes three cities a week, oftentimes three cities a week, and, you know, lived out of a suitcase in hotels. And it was just really intense from a stress perspective. And so just questioning, like, if I wanted to keep doing that and what else I wanted to do. So I left, wasn't 100% sure exactly what I was going to do. Left right around the time of George Floyd's murder. I knew I wanted to focus on women of color issues, but I wasn't exactly sure in what format or what fashion. And I sold my book right after his murder, like within a few weeks. And so everything happened really quickly. Mm-hmm. And I also helped co-found Enformation. That was a little bit more in the making, but in all candor, because of the pandemic and everything going virtual, we had to really pivot our model and really think about what we were gonna do. And so it's a group for professional women of color to come together to find community, to talk about how we make work for more of us. And we call it creating safe space, brave space, and new space, but just to talk about issues that I don't think have been talked about before. And so that's really what I'm doing. I do a lot of research and writing on women of color topics. And, you know, I think I picked those topics. I knew that's what I was going to do prior to, I think, DE&I being in the forefront of where it is now. And so in some ways, I feel like I picked something that's just, you know, getting a lot of detention, you know, by luck or by default. But in other ways, like, it just feels like I've stepped into something that is what I was meant to do. So it's really an interesting space. And it's so new still that it takes a minute of reflection sometimes. So.
Absolutely. And how brave of you to step away in that transition from that safe, secure Deloitte, you know, world to jumping out on your own and really starting this this kind of movement that you're a part of.
Yeah.
So, like a day in your life. Like, what are you doing now?
Yeah, so I just put out a book. It came out 6 months ago. And so I spent the last, you know, year and a half, honestly, writing, editing, making book covers, doing all those kinds of things. And then with the first 6 months of any book launch, you do a lot of podcasts, a lot of talking, a lot of interviews. And so there was a lot of press and a lot of, you know, conversations with companies who would want me to come in and talk about the book. It's called The First, The Few, The Only, How Women of Color, you know, Reimagine Power in Corporate America. And so I've done a lot of talks with companies. And I've also done a lot of my, again, additional pieces of research and continuing to talk to women of color and women about how we improve work. And so it's a lot of discussion, interview, research. I'm starting this fall in a fellowship at Harvard Business School. And so I'll be doing a little bit of teaching and a little bit more on campus. So I feel like my travel schedule is about to pick up a little bit with, you know, the fall speaking schedule also kicking off. Like, it's quiet in the summer. And in the fall, a lot of the women's conferences pick up. So I'm traveling quite a bit in October. So it's a lot of just speaking and talking about concepts in the book and talking about how we move or help women move from just kind of surviving at work to really thriving. What does that look like in this moment for women?
Amazing. I feel like being a teacher at heart, we get so much satisfaction about sharing some of the experiences that we've gone through, right? So did you feel like Well, okay. So first of all, women in the workplace, I worked in a very male-dominated industry for a very long time. And I feel like there is a gap with the confidence of females coming into this world and feeling like they have a voice at the table and to speak up. So I love that you're kind of focused on that, and then you'll be teaching on that as well. Like, what are some of the practical things you're sharing to, help these young women, like getting into these roles, like really getting their voice? Like, what type of things are you talking
Yeah.
about?
It's interesting because I feel like sometimes when we talk about things like confidence, we put it upon the woman, right? Like she doesn't have confidence or it's some sort of deficit. And part of why I wrote the book and I do this research is because I think so much of us internalize that message that it's something wrong with us, something we have to do more of. And part of my message is a lot of the systemic issues that we were, raised in or that we find at the workplace are not our responsibility to change. And so much why I think I don't want to call it lack confidence, but question our confidence maybe, is because of the messages we got growing up from our teachers, from media, from never having seen ourselves for a lot of the women of color I work with represented in any sort of form or fashion. Like I never saw myself on television or in a magazine or, in a movie, never saw myself on the news. Like never, when you never see yourself, you never know what you can be, right? Almost that whole you have to see it to be it. So I think there's a little bit of just what society and what culture does to women and especially to little girls of color and how we start to change that narrative. But for me, like there was a really startling moment where I knew it was time for me to leave. I was really questioning, where I was going to go and what I was going to do next. It took me almost 3 years to leave, to be candid with you, because I felt so responsible. I was a senior partner. I had like really strived hard to get to the seat. I was one of the first ones. And so I just felt like there were a lot of eyes on me. And so, in an attempt to figure out what I wanted to do, I started meeting with women of color. It started one-on-one, and then it turned into these series of dinners where I met like 300 senior, I would say VP level and above women, like in very short order and very quick fashion. And the conversations we would have were so similar and so related. We could finish each other's sentences. I thought we'd get together for an hour or two and we'd be there for 6, 7 hours later. And I share that because there was one story in the first dinner that just kind of became a thread that I saw throughout, and it's the reason I do this work. It was a public company CFO, a Black woman, and she said, "I sit in a seat of power, and yet I don't feel powerful." And it really struck me. That was how so many of the women in the room were feeling. Like they had given up parts of themselves. They were conforming. They, were not really bringing all of themselves to work. There were lots of these messages, doing extra just to kind of even get to the table. And part of what this work is about is how do we make more women feel powerful? How do we show up so that we're not just taking our seat, but we're in full voice? And that's a very different conversation that I think is new and that we're just starting to have, that it's not just about getting to the table, but if we don't feel confident and happy and in full voice once we're there, it's hard to make change. And so many of the women I interviewed were sitting in these really powerful seats and almost, I don't want to say regretting it, but like questioning if all the sacrifice was worth it. And that's part of what has to change. It can't be about all the sacrifice of yourself to get to the seat. And then, you're so depleted that you can't show up in a different sort of way.
Yes. And the expectations set on you right when you finally reach that point, to speak up or have a different opinion or, to speak out. It comes down to leadership. I feel like if you feel confident in where you're at, but that's kind of a step beyond like the imposter syndrome, like maybe I'm not worthy to be here, but maybe they are worthy to be there. And now it sounds like they're feeling like they're vulnerable, because if they don't, play the game just right, that's a really interesting conversation to get started.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of that sort of discussion. There's a chapter in the book that I say I didn't want to write, and it's called How to Play the Game While You Change the Game. And so much of the book is about playing, sorry, is about changing the game. And yet I got a lot of pressure to talk about like, but what can you do to rise when you're in the systems? And kind of got to this place where I realized like, we can't have everyone leave right now, right? And some of this is about how do we actually survive when we're in systems that maybe, again, weren't created for us, don't necessarily work for us. And how do we show up in a different way that doesn't feel that sort of depleting or taking from us, right? And that's, again, it's not conversations we have often, but I think it's part where we get power from realizing it's not just us, right? That this is a universal know, challenge for so many groups of people, not just women, right? But just a lot of different groups who are not sitting in, you know, traditionally have not sat in power seats. And so it's really, you know, for me, a lot of this work is about redefining how we see leadership and realizing that leadership can look a lot of different ways, but we have like a very narrow definition of what leadership looks like. And as a result, I think a lot of us don't see ourselves. A lot of us give up, you know, parts of our voice. And how do we expand that definition? Because if we ever needed different kinds of leadership, if we ever needed new thoughts and new ways of leading, it's right now, right? And we see that coming out of the pandemic. So.
Absolutely. I think I read that women on boards of public companies were still obviously behind statistically than men. But the companies that do have women on the board tend to be more profitable. Have you read that?
Yeah, absolutely. That is all the research suggests that. And it's not just one, right? It's you know, having two or three women really makes a difference on a board and sitting in the C-suite as well. So there's a lot of emerging research that suggests, and even I think the pandemic is another example where there were leaders in countries that were women. You saw, you know, much more, I don't know what's the right word, like you quick action around COVID, like in a different sort of way that was, and a lot of people are calling that empathetic leadership, right? Like making space for actually being vulnerable and being empathetic, which historically we haven't really embraced, especially in the business world, right? Like it was kind of like, it's all thinking, right? Logic and keep everything else, the emotion out of it. And I think what we're starting to see is a pivot to a different kind of conversation that leadership in business requires all of those characteristics, not just one or the other.
Yes, absolutely. What a big topic. Like, there's so many caveats to it, and there's so many like rabbit holes you could go down and really kind of discover even more. I think it's fascinating, and I think it's what we do need, a kind of a new perspective on that leadership. It's not all about the bottom line, even though I know you're as a public company, even a private company, you're trying to make money. But I do feel like there's a way to be more inclusive. And okay, let's talk about a little bit about imposter syndrome. Like, are you hearing people in those roles still feel like they aren't speaking up because they're still kind of going through that?
Yeah, you know, maybe a good example to kind of pull apart is because you brought up boards, is boards. Like what we have found is that so many women who are interested in being on boards, one, don't feel like they're qualified. So they don't even raise their hand or don't reply. And the few that do, when they go through the process, they're evaluated in this very sort of traditional way, right? Have you had a P&L responsibility? Have you managed like 500 people? Have you had a global experience? And I'm not suggesting women don't have that. But we're just stepping into a lot of those roles. We're just seeing the first generation that's had some of that. So I call it like having to have been there to do it. Like if that's the criteria, we're going to get less women in those roles because the things you're looking for are not really, again, that new definition of leadership of what we need. So it's an example of it's not really, again, internal imposter syndrome, but feeling like, yeah, I don't have that list of what's required. But is that the right list? You know, is it really our imposter syndrome or is it the messages we're getting that really are causing that? And so that's really where I think, you know, there's a lot of new writing around imposter syndrome, really trying to pull apart what are you responsible for in imposter syndrome and what is it coming from the outside? And I talk about it as almost like, what do you not have to take in? Because that's really about them and not about what you believe about yourself. But again, we haven't really, you know, this is new thinking, very cutting edge sort of research in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. So while you're doing all this research and writing these books, and really focused on this new thing, how are you keeping yourself motivated to continue?
Yeah, you know, for me, like the motivation is really easy. I spent 21 years in this career where it was so focused on kind of rising and serving my clients and doing work that was interesting, but maybe not necessarily what I was called to do. And so this just feels to be able to make an impact and to, you know, make a living around it is really fascinating and really, you know, fulfilling in itself. I would also tell you as the book gets into more women's hands or, you know, as I write pieces and I hear from people who say like, that's exactly how I felt, but I've never heard anyone say it before, or that's exactly what I would say, but I've never said it out loud. Part of why I wrote the book is because I wanted women to be seen, right? To literally see themselves on the page, because when you don't see yourself, it's hard to realize again, that it's not you and there's not something wrong with you. And so, Yeah, that just keeps me going. This sense of putting voice to something that I think a lot of us feel, but there's so few people putting voice to. And I think part of it is most women don't step out of corporate, like at a senior level, right? Like I chose to step out when I still had 20 more years in front of me. And I think that's really what gives me a little bit of an interesting vantage point to kind of talk about this. I'm not in my retirement, you know, stage looking back. I kind of just made a choice because I felt like these were topics that I really wanted to talk about. Again, if I didn't know exactly in what form or fashion, but I felt like this real earnest calling to want to put voice to them.
Amazing. Yeah, I think when you have your passion can become ingrained with what you're doing, it like makes it easier to get up every day. You're like,
yeah. Yeah, it doesn't feel like work. And I know people like say, like, there's so many sayings about that, or like find your passion and make it your work. But this, I did a lot of other things for a lot of years. And this feels a little bit more like I'm discovering, you know, my own journey. I'm like learning about myself. I also feel like I'm learning a lot about maybe how, why I was wired the way I was. And again, what's mine and what kind of comes from my culture or how I was brought up. And so it's just, it's kind of, it's really exciting in that sense, sort of sense too.
So. Yeah. And it's really cool that you do have so much experience. Like 20 years, boy, is you went through a lot of things with that company, right? With and with your ability to move up in that company, were some of those challenges that you had pivotal in like in this writing and in what you're doing now?
Yeah, so I interviewed 500 women of color in writing the stories, in writing the book. And so I really wanted to put voice because I, you know, I'm conscious of the fact that women of color is a big label and not everyone likes it. And there's so much nuance to it. So I really wanted to show the variety. And part of, I think, being seen is telling all those stories. So I didn't just tell 10 women's stories. Like I tried to tell as many stories, you know, and I think there's some people that wanted like more full stories, but I really wanted to show the variety that we come from all over the world and we've had such different experiences. Your first generation, or if you were born here, if, you know, your history is more related to enslavement versus immigration. There's so much, you know, so much of a different history to all of that. And so I think part of it was wanting to tell all their stories. I think for me, a lot of what I, you know, felt was I was a first. I didn't necessarily see role models that looked like me, you know, whether it was, and I found it more even at my clients. I worked in the tech and telecom space for most of my career. And those are also male dominated industries. So I was often the only woman of color in the room. And so, yeah, it was some of the things I was sorting through. But for me, a lot of what I was challenged with was I made partner really young as well. And so it was more age related that I would get lots of comments about, you know, looking young or being young or where's the most senior person in the room. And so when you talk about imposter syndrome or confidence, I think that things like that do make you question, like, you know, so what am I doing wrong that people don't think I'm senior enough? Like I have the title, but I'm not presenting in that sort of way. And I got to the place where I realized that was more about them and not about me. So yeah, some of it's based on my own experience, but a lot of it is just, I got to meet so many women that I saw patterns. And I think, again, we're talking about these things now more, but 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we didn't talk about these things in the way that I was taught, you know, was able to hold space or ask questions. And so it was just really more pattern finding and seeing how universal the experience was that we were going through. Yet there's such isolation when you're in these high performing spaces that you don't talk about these things. Yeah.
Excellent. So I know you just wrote a book and I love, and we'll definitely have that information and link if anyone wants to check it out, all the information will be below. But do you have any book that when you meet people that you would recommend, like this is a book I recommend for you to read right now?
You know, there's so many amazing books on DE&I, especially. Again, that's a lot of what I get called in to do. And so, you know, I often say to people, like, I am not the ally sort of expert. Like my research is deep in women of color. And it's surprising to me how often I'm actually called into a company and asked to talk about allyship. So I think it's really understanding there's a lot of people doing research in this space and that one book or one thing is not going to, you know, serve everything. And so really understanding that. So I think it's a little bit of finding books that speak to various experiences. And then if you're going to work in the DE&I space, you almost have to have a library of books. I do. I have a large stack of it. I can go through them, but I have a large stack of books that I read and I'm reading all the time because I also can't answer every question, right? Like I'm not going to get it right every time. And I think that's what's different about DE&I compared to other topics or other spaces. Like it's not like, you know, what's a good, like some sort of data analysis, or it's not like you can go learn this skill and then, you know, yes, you have to continue to read on it, but you know the skill. D&I is not like that. It's varied, it's nuanced, it's different for every person you meet. And so my recommendation is read as much as you can and to read a variety of topics, you know, read allyship, but read books on women of color, read, you know, books on immigrants, read, you know, books on what the history is for Black Americans, right, in this country, and getting all of that so that you understand the variety of experiences is what I would suggest.
I love that. And for those listening, diversity and inclusion is what you're referring to.
Yes. Yes.
Excellent.
Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Yes.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I got that too. Yep. Diversity, equity. I love that. Like, yeah, read. I am an avid reader. So I think that we should all be continuing to educate. And this topic, you're right, it's evolving, right? It is continuing to evolve. And based on the company you're at, based on the culture that you're in, based on the position that you have, it's all kind of relevant, almost like to you, right? And your situation.
Absolutely. But also getting that variety, right? Like, you're not going to read one book on inclusion and then be done. I think that's also part of the message. Like, I think you'd be surprised how many people will be like, need you come do an hour on allyship? And then they think they're done. Like, it's not, this kind of work doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So since we are books, beauty, and business.
Yes.
What is your favorite beauty tip?
I am trying to drink more water. So that's really like top of mind for me. But I would also say, like, my tip is that I think I spent so much time in my like 20s and 30s, like focused on like outward appearance, right? Like what makeup I was wearing and how I styled my hair. And what I've realized from meeting all these amazing women and even just my own journey is that beauty really comes from the inside. And if you don't like yourself, if you don't know yourself, if you don't haven't gone through the work to like fix the inside, it doesn't matter what you slap on the outside, like it still comes across. And so much of confidence comes from the inside. And so really, you know, it's not a hard and fast beauty rule, but it's really like doing the work on the inside, because if you don't do that, it doesn't really matter what the outside looks like.
I completely agree that confidence it does come from inside. I love the drink more water too.
Yeah. I'm trying to do that.
I love that, but that is so true. Like, it does come from within, and it's a daily thing, right? It's how we see ourselves on a daily. I think that's great. So what, speaking of daily, as you're going throughout your day, what are some daily habits or tips that you do? Successful people tend to have a trend of they do these types of things every day. Do you have any daily tips for success? Yeah.
It's so interesting. Like, I spent so much of my life like in that sort of rigorous, structured sort of format, right? Like where I had all that. Like, I'm in a place now where I listen more to what I feel like doing every day, or, you know, like today is like a tired day. So, you know, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm also really conscious that like doing writing and research and this kind of work is very different than getting on a call and like leading a meeting. And it is much more creative. So it doesn't come all the time, right? And so I was sharing with somebody, I get lots of calls and like, well, how did you actually physically write your book? And I got into this practice where I would hold Fridays and Mondays and like make all of my meetings like with people Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Cause I would find like that's very different energy to kind of have like an interaction or be answering questions or very tactical sort of meetings. And I almost needed Friday to decompress and get into a different, more, you know, creative space. And it would really be on like, you know, Saturday and Sunday by the time I actually started writing, you know, into Monday. And so really just being conscious of like how your energy flows, like the kind of work that you're doing. And that so many of us have been taught, like there is a certain way of working and a certain schedule and everything has to be planned ahead. And I did that. And yes, I was successful. But there's almost something I think more beautiful of like just listening to like what feels right and, you know, paying more attention. And I think that's what the last 2 years have taught a lot of us, that sort of one way of like that one recipe for success. Although, you know, there's certain things, you know, that are good for you. Like, you know, if people have to have coffee in the morning or drink, you know, like eat breakfast, like, you know, yeah. If that's, you know, that's how you get your energy, like do those. But the other, it's just really more, having less like structure around some of this and just letting conversations emerge. Or I'm finding like, it's so fascinating to see like who shows up or who I meet that 3 weeks from now, I'll make a connection and it's so productive, but in the moment, it may not feel that way. And so everything doesn't have to be so structured and so analyzed, and that's a very different way that of operating for me. So I think I'm still transitioning to like this more flexible sort of way of working.
Yes, I love that. And I think you're absolutely right, understanding where your energy's at and when you're in that productive, creative flow, and when you're not. And I think it's important, even I am somewhat structured in my day still. And I do feel like I know when I'm on, and that's my time. And then I know my downtime too. And I think there's a lot to that and understanding that. And that's funny for you. Like you're coming from such a 20-year career of being, on all day.
High performing, right? Like really intense. And so like I'm trying not to do that. So it's almost like I'm unlearning all of those rules, and trying to
Absolutely.
figure out what works now and like, what kind of life do I want? Like, I mean, I know it's very much a luxury, but I get to decide like how do I want to work and where do I want to work and what does that look like and who do I want to interact with? But, like it's interesting. It's a very different way of being in the world. Then, when you're incorporated, you kind of have to do things because it's what's expected of the job.
Absolutely. And you're doing such great work too. And the things that you're teaching and learning and educating about are going to make a difference for so many people.
I hope so. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, it will. So that's super exciting. Well, any ad additional motivation or advice for the ladies that are listening?
Yeah, I think I always try and leave like with this one thought. Like so much of what I studied in the book in the last couple of years has been about power, right? And how so many of the women I interviewed had such a negative like reaction to the word power and like just such a bad sort of relationship with the idea of power. And my parting thought would be like we all have power. It just may be different than what we think of or we've been taught. And then it's really important to figure out what power is for us and to kind of find ways to step into it. But that everyone has power in almost all situations, even if it doesn't feel like it. And figuring out how you understand that in those moments of crisis is really like when I've met so many women over the last couple of years, like the women who are truly powerful, they're not like powerful because they have a big job. They're powerful because they have figured out what matters to them and how to set boundaries and how to show up for themselves and what matters. And so, that would be my advice is that power comes from the inside, but that, we all have it, even if we don't think we do.
I love that. I think too, I was reading something that you had written about and it reminded me when you said some people are uncomfortable with power, certain situations that we kind of find ourselves frozen in, not really understanding how to handle it in the best way. What is your advice around that and that inner power that you have?
Yeah, I think some of it is practice. And I don't think we talk about that enough. Like we see people who are like, they're so powerful or they're so influential or they're so put together. Those people worked hard, I don't mean like worked hard in a structured sort of format, but they've done a lot of work to get to that place. And we don't like pay attention to that. Like it's interesting. It's like a theme in the book. Like the book is really about trailblazers, right? But really understanding the shadow side of trailblazing. We only talk about the trailblazers as and hold them up as like these like great examples of people who've made it. We don't often talk about like how hard it was and like the negative side of it. And that's the part I want to talk about. Because if we don't talk about that, we can't change it. We're just going to point to like these five people who've made it and say like everyone should be like them. I don't want everyone to be like them because they had to sacrifice so much, right, to get there. So I think it's like just a different message around all of that.
Absolutely. And I like what you said about practicing. I think when you're prepared a little bit more to handle situations that come at you, and I mean, obviously we can't know everything that's going to come at us, but how understanding how we do want to handle that and where our power is in those situations is great advice.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you a very practical one. Like a lot of the women of color I work with, and then I'll do the translation for allies. But for a lot of the women of color I work with like, get stuck in situations where there's a microaggression or there's a racist incident. Like they just kind of freeze or don't, like to your point, like they just get frozen. And part of it is we never grew up like learning really about racism or talking about it. Like so many of the women I interviewed, I assumed they grew up like talking about these topics, and hardly anyone did, which is surprising to me. And so you get in these situations that are uncomfortable, especially at work, and we've been taught to be nice, right? Or to be polite to our colleagues. And so, yeah, that sense of freezing. And then what you find in the research is then these women spend 3, 4 days beating themselves up for not saying anything. So it's like this, like really unpleasant cycle. And so what I tell the women I work with to think about is like, you kind of know, like for me, I know I'm going to get comments about my age. I know I'm going to get comments about my last name because it's 13 letters long. I'm going to be asked like why I speak English so well because people are going to assume that I'm foreign. Like I know that like from having lived in this country for, for my whole life. And so like I now practice what I'm going to say when those things come up. And I say the same thing to the women I work with. Like think about the things that happen to you on a regular basis. You kind of know what's going to show up for you. And so practice writing out what you want to say in those moments, but then practice saying them out loud because that moment of freeze is real. And what I tell allies who I call co-conspirators in the book is I want you to practice too, because you all have been taught to be nice and to be polite and just almost like ignore bad behavior unless you really have to intervene, especially at work. I think we're better about hopefully handling it in the wider world, but at work, there's still something about, well, that's my colleague. I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. But if you can practice saying something like what was just said doesn't feel right to me, or can we just pause? I just want to unpack what was just said, or I don't know if it hurt anybody else, but that comment really hurt me. I just need to say that. Like whatever that is for you, we'll practice saying that. So in those moments when something is said or done, or you just know that it's not right, like you know what to say. Cause I just think we're all caught flat-footed. And so yeah, so much of this is about practice and it's about getting comfortable with uncomfortable topics that we've been taught to be uncomfortable about, but they don't have to necessarily be uncomfortable. And I think we're in a moment where more people are asking us to talk about them and acknowledge them, but we have to find ways to talk about.
I love that. I think that's great advice. Or, I mean, I used that with my daughter in a separate situation, but she there's mean girls in middle school, you know, and like, and you don't think about this, but you want to be prepared if someone says something like, "How are you going to handle it in a constructive but right way to deflect or redirect or move on?" And then it's almost like we shouldn't have to think about that as adults in the workplace. Like, come on, people, we're all grown-ups here. But the fact that there still are side comments and things made, and yeah, I love that it's being addressed. I think we all need to. That would be a great workshop. I would totally come do
Yeah,
it.
no, and I think you're right. Like, we sometimes teach little girls what to say, but sometimes we just say like, grin and bear it, or just walk away. But is that really on these topics? Do we just want to keep walking away, or how do we get people to change their behavior if we're not going to talk about it? So, yeah, I think it's all again all related. Like, that's what's so fascinating about this work is it's so related to how we were raised and what we were taught as little boys, little girls, or just in our community. So.
Absolutely. Well, this has been so fun to talk with you today. I really appreciate you taking time and coming on the podcast and sharing about your book and about your research. I will definitely be following you in the future.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your university working with Harvard later in the fall. So that'll be so fun for you.
Thank you. I so appreciate you having me and sharing the message and for the work that you do as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for listening. Bye.